everyone, and welcome to episode 43 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Now, if you've listened to this podcast before, or you've watched my TED Talk, or listened to me talk, read a couple of my books perhaps, you kind of know my story already. I'm one of these people who loved the Middle Ages forever, but then, you know, went to school and learned what we all learned, which was this time was terrible and dirty and violent and all of those horrible things. It wasn't until I went to university that I started to get my old idea of the Middle Ages back, where it was a time full of human beings with great ideas and heartaches and inspiration and all of these things. So one of the first places where I found that was in a medieval romance course that was taught by the amazing Dr. Joanne Finden at Trent University. And that's where I first encountered Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And that was just an amazing story for me. It really opened my mind to what people thought at the time, what some of the issues that they might be thinking about were, that kind of thing. And I've talked about Gawain before, so I'm not going to talk about that much today. But I do want to talk about the other really mind-blowing work that I came across. And that was The City of Ladies by Christine de Pizan. And I came across this in the amazing Dr. Suzanne Conklin-Akbari's class at University of Toronto. She had us read the book of The City of Ladies. And this was mind-blowing for me. Because I think that often we have this impression of women in the Middle Ages being kind of quiet or downtrodden or at least not able to speak their minds. And Christine is an example of a woman who was not only super educated, but a woman who made her living by speaking her mind, by writing. And this is just an amazing story about an amazing person. So if you haven't heard of Christine de Pizan, buckle up, kiddies, because I'm going to tell you about a woman who was at least as influential as Chaucer was in her own time and afterwards. And to my mind, a heck of a lot more interesting. So let's talk about Christine de Pizan. I haven't talked about her much on the podcast before because, to be perfectly honest, Christine is one of my heroes and I wanted to do her justice. So today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about her life, throw in some of her writings as we go on, and hopefully that will give you a good impression of Christine and make you want to read more of her stuff. So Christine de Pizan, she's born in Venice around 1364. The Hundred Years' War is going to have a huge influence on Christine de Pizan's life later. So she's born in Venice, but she's not Christine of Venice. She's Christine de Pizan because her father, Thomas, is from Pizan. He's an astrologer and he's a physician. And if you were listening to the podcast for the last couple of weeks, you'll have heard that astrology and medicine were not all that unrelated. Astrology was considered a science, so it was a perfectly legitimate career. And in fact, Thomas was so good at this and so famous that he was asked by the king of France, Charles V, to become the astrologer for the French court. So Thomas moves to Paris, and a few years later, Christine and her mother moved to Paris as well. Christine's growing up at the French court. Her father's in favor. Everything is quite good. Her mother suggests that Christine doesn't need to be educated. Things are going well for them. She can have a good marriage. It's not important for a girl to learn all sorts of things that she might never need. But Thomas encourages Christine to learn. He encourages her to read and to get to know a lot of the really important writers of history. And so Christine does this. So she reads really widely across classical texts. So Aristotle, Plato, Ovid, Boethius. She's also reading the Church Fathers too. And Christine is very aware that the fact that she is a girl in a boy's world is one that has held her back a little bit from her education. And she writes about this later. When she's writing about her father, she writes about him having these two jewels that have steered his life. One is his knowledge of astrology and one is his knowledge of medicine. And when she talks about her education in relation to those, this is one of the things that she says. Because I was born a girl, it was not at all ordained that I should benefit in any way from my father's wealth, and I could not inherit, more because of custom than justice, the possessions that are found in the very worthy fountain. If justice reigned, the female would lose nothing in this regard, nor would the son. But I am entirely certain that custom is stronger than justice in many places, and because of this, I lost, through lack of learning, any chance of taking this very rich treasure. Thus, this custom displeases me, for if it were otherwise, I assume that I would have been extremely rich with the treasure that comes from the fountain. for I was well inclined in this direction, and I still have great desire, which does not date from yesterday, to draw deeply from the fountain. I desire this more than any earthly thing, but my desire is worthless because of the above-mentioned custom. May God curse it. So obviously, she thought she should be educated. She thought it was worthwhile for her to be educated because she was really interested in these topics. She knew that because she was a girl, that was going to hold her back. Now, her father was forward-thinking, like I said, so she was able to read a lot. But again, this was kind of something that her mother didn't think was necessary. So Christine, throughout her writing, says she's very lucky that she was able to read these things. So things are going well for the family. Again, Thomas is still held in high regard at the court, and Christine is able to marry Etienne de Castel, who is a court notary. So he's a secretary in the French court, and he's about 25. And this is a beautiful match, two people who actually really love each other, and they get married in 1380. So Etienne at this time is 25, Christine is about 15. Christine's marriage to Etienne was a very happy one. She has nothing bad to say about him. In fact, when she writes about him later, this is one of the things that she says. She says, "I constantly remember the man because of whom, and of no other, I used to lead a joyous, even glorious life until death snatched him away. In my opinion, he was without equal in the world. I could not have wished for anyone more wise, prudent, handsome, and good than he was in all respects. He loved me, and that was right, for I was given to him when I was young. Our love and our two hearts were completely in accord, much more than between brothers and sisters. Our two wills were one, whether it was a question of joy or of sorrow. His company was so pleasing for me that when he was near me, there was no living woman more overwhelmed with the good things of life, for he showered upon me to the best of his ability every pleasing, delightful, and enjoyable thing. It is right that he used to please me. No more, alas. In truth, he pleased me so much that if I devoted all my time to praising him, I do not think that I could say enough good about him." Now we know, in the Middle Ages, people were pretty enthusiastic about the things that they liked. But as we'll see later on, this devotion to Etienne, it's not just lip service. These two were really, really connected. And it was a love match, which is all you could ask for. So these two got married. Christine and Etienne got married around 1380. Around the same time, things started to go badly. So Charles V dies, which means that his son, Charles VI, becomes king of France. But Charles VI is only 12. So he's got two uncles that rule as regents, and these uncles are constantly in conflict. Not only that, but Thomas is no longer in favor at the court, which means that he loses his income and they lose a lot of status. Thomas dies sometime around 1385-ish, which means that Etienne and Christine are responsible for Christine's mother, and they're taking care of her while they're having three children. Everything seems to be going okay, but losing her father was a big deal for Christine. Christine and Etienne have three children. They have two sons and a daughter. We don't know the name of one of the sons. He doesn't live to adulthood, but we know that one of her sons is named Jean and her daughter's name is Marie. Things are going all right for Etienne and Christine until about 1389. And because Etienne is part of the French court, he's off with the king in Beauvais when he becomes ill and he dies suddenly. So not only has he died, but he's died far from home. So Christine couldn't be with him when he died. And this is a huge deal for her. And she mourns him for the rest of her life. She never again marries. Not only that, but Christine has lost her father and she's lost her husband. And as much as she is kind of an educated woman, and this is a good thing, she still needed those two men in her life for financial support. And all of a sudden, they're gone. Christine has to take care of her three children, her mother, and her niece, and she's not quite sure how she's going to do that. Etienne has died while having a whole bunch of loans out. So there's a whole bunch of money that is owed to Christine, and she has to get it back. And she has to do this through the court system. It takes her 20 years to fight for all the money that is owed to her. And this is something that takes a huge toll on her. And she comes back to it in her own writing. And this is, again, something else that kind of tells us a little bit about life in widowhood at the time. Then, most importantly for us, Christine begins to write. So I've said that she has to support her family now. She decides she's going to do this as a writer. And this never happens. Not only did it never happen for women, Christine is thought to have been the first professional author who was a woman, but also not even men were writing professionally as their only source of income. And this is mentioned in the Norton version of this, and I'll give you links to all the texts that I'm talking about today. But not even men were writing professionally as their sole source of income, because we know that men who were writing at this time were mostly brought up by the church. They often had church posts that would pay their salary, and then they could write on the side. Well, Christine strikes out as a writer on her own. She's actually really successful at that. So I've mentioned that losing Etienne was a big deal for Christine. She never does get over it. She does a lot of writing about this. In my book, the one I've just written, Life in Medieval Europe, I talk about Christine when I talk about grief, because I think that there's an idea that because death was so frequent in the Middle Ages, people became quite used to it. And I think that if we listen to Christine's voice, we can hear just how devastated people were when they lost someone they loved, just as they are today. So here's one of her ballads about widowhood from a collection called 100 Ballads. This is number 14. She says, "Alone and in great suffering, in this deserted world full of sadness, has my sweet lover left me. He possessed my heart in greatest joy without grief. Now he is dead. I'm weighed down by grievous mourning, and such sadness has gripped my heart that I will always weep for his death. What can I do? It's not surprising that I weep and sigh with my dear lover dead. For when I look deeply into my heart and I see how sweetly and without hardship I lived from my childhood and first youth with him, I'm assailed by such great pain that I will always weep for his death. I'm like a turtle dove without its mate, who turns away from greenery and heads toward aridity, or like a lamb the wolf attempts to kill, which panics when its shepherd leaves it. Thus I am left in great distress by my lover, which gives me so much pain that I will always weep for his death." In another one of her ballads, she actually mentions that her grief is driving her to contemplate suicide, which is a mortal sin. This is a big deal. So for her to write that, obviously she's feeling very deeply. But it's not just that Christine misses him. She thinks of this death as being transformational for her, like literally transformational for her. She writes a book called The Book of Fortune's Transformation, where she talks about her life and she talks about this in metaphorical terms. She talks about being brought into the palace of Hymen, so representing marriage, and that's where she meets her husband and they live very well together. And then this is what she says about him. "I was above all honored by him into whose keeping I'd been given, who worked hard for me so that experiencing no difficulties, I felt comfortable at that court. And he was so faithful to me and so good that by my soul, I could not praise highly enough the good things that I received from him. He was handsome and good under all circumstances, wise, courtly, and upright, and he greatly valued nobility and learning. And with his great knowledge of navigation, he could very competently steer a ship in any weather. He was a very knowledgeable master of a vessel and knew very well how to direct it, just as he should." And what she means by this is not that he's actually a navigator. We know he was a court notary, but he's able to sail the ship of life. And so when he dies, she describes it as his going down in the middle of a storm. He's swept from the ship and he's lost at sea. And she wants to go after him. She wants to dive into the ocean after him, and she's held back. Eventually, the storm passes and Christine's kind of passed out. And then she feels a transformation in her body. And in this book, she actually transforms into a man. And she becomes a man and she repairs the ship that's been shipwrecked. And she begins to be the person who's sailing it. And so she's talking about how she has to actually take over this life, the role that her husband had played in life, and she has to start building this life for herself. So she's becoming a professional writer. She's taking on the debts that are owed to him. She's fighting in court. She's becoming this person that to her represents not only her in her past life as a woman, but also she's taking on all these, what she thinks of as manly traits in order to steer this ship. And this is a really fascinating way of looking at how she has to take over, and how so many medieval women would have had to do this as widows, not as writers, but they'd have to take the helm of a ship that they never thought they'd have to steer. So it's the 1390s now, and Christine is starting to write, and because she is well known in the French court, she's starting to get a lot of patrons from the people who are in the French court, the rich people. They have some pity on her, and they start to commission things from her, and she's writing. In 1396, she is in the French court when Richard II from England comes over and marries Isabella. This is an important moment in her life because she meets the Count of Salisbury. And this is important because she decides she's going to send her son Jean to go with the Count of Salisbury to be fostered. This is a very common thing. People were sending their children out to be fostered in different places so that they could learn the skills that they needed. And the Count of Salisbury is a reputable guy. It was a good placement for Jean. Now, if you know anything about the Hundred Years' War or English history, the year 1397, the name Richard II, it should set off some alarm bells for you. And sure enough, things started to go badly. In England, 1399 is when Richard II is overthrown by Henry IV. And Christine's son Jean is still in England at this time. It's going to become kind of important in a minute, but this is one of the ways in which Christine is really entangled in the Hundred Years' War as it's going on. In 1399, Christine also writes The God of Love's Letter. So we know that Christine she's been a widow for about a decade at this point. She's around 35, and it's starting to grate on her as she reads and writes how women are being perceived in the world. And again, she's somebody who's had to take on kind of the yin and the yang. She's a person who really has experience in a man's world, and it's really bothering her how people speak about women. So she writes The God of Love's Letter, which is in the voice of Cupid, and he's talking to lovers. But she starts to come up with some things that are going to really influence how she writes about women for the rest of her life. In The God of Love's Letter, Cupid starts to go off on men who put down women. This is what Cupid says about women and men. He says, "For every man should be well disposed toward women, who are the mothers of all of them. Nor are they bitter or fickle toward their offspring, but rather soothing, sweet, and friendly. They are responsive and helpful to the needs of their sons. They have done and continue to do so many good things for their sons. They consider any activity good which leads to the gentle nourishment of man's body. At his birth, during his lifetime, at his death, women are helpful and useful to him, understanding, sweet, and obliging. The man who slanders women is self-centered, rude, and full of ingratitude. Furthermore, I say that a man behaves unnaturally when he defames or slanders or reproaches women by blaming her, whether it is a question of one or two or of all women generally. Even granting that some women are foolish or full of every kind of vice or faithless in love and lacking all loyalty or proud, wicked, cruel, or inconstant, fickle, changeable, or crafty, false-hearted, and deceptive, should all women therefore be put in the same category with not a single exception? When God on high created the angels, the cherubim, the seraphim, and the archangels, were there not some who acted badly? Should all angels be deemed wicked because of this? The man who knows an evil woman should be on his guard against her, not defame a third or a quarter of all womankind, slandering every sort of feminine behavior. For there have been, are, and shall be many women worthy of praise for goodness and graciousness, in whom virtue and beauty abide, whose good sense and morality have withstood the test. And those men who blame women who are less than perfect are, I repeat, in error if they name them or tell who they are or where and how they live." So this is one of Christine's early writings, and it's the type of thing that I think we may not expect from a medieval woman. The type of thing where I think if you come across it, you think, my goodness, like this woman must have been charged with witchcraft or something like that. But the thing is that Christine only got to be more popular, and she only got to be more vocal. So I think this tells us a lot about what our prejudices are about medieval society, because obviously you could have a woman who had these opinions in the court, and people listened. People may not have always agreed, but they listened. So this brings us to around 1401, 1402. And Christine, obviously, she has opinions about how women are treated, how they should be treated. And one of the things that really gets to her is a poem called The Romance of the Rose. And this is a much earlier poem. It's by Guillaume de Lory and Jean de Meun. It was first written by Guillaume de Lory, and he passed away. And so it was finished by Jean de Meun. But it's one of these things where at first it was a poem that was, you know, not especially offensive. But when Jean de Meun takes over, he just turns it up to 11. So he becomes more offensive in his language. He becomes more offensive in the way he portrays women. And, you know, even at this time, Christine is looking at this being like, this is a terrible piece of literature. Why is anyone recommending this? We shouldn't be reading this. So she and a lot of other intellectuals at the time start to write about The Romance of the Rose, saying it's terrible. And there's a lot of pushback on this. And the writing that she does around this time around The Romance of the Rose is really interesting because it sounds a bit like a Twitter feud in that eventually she says, listen, man, this is horrible. I've explained why. I'm obviously not going to convince you, so I'm not going to talk about this anymore. But this is a really terrible piece of literature. It's not fair how it treats women, and I really disagree with it. And again, like, Christine is not, there is no pushback on Christine personally in a way that's detrimental to her. There are people that are arguing with her, but it's only making her more famous. And I think it's because there are a lot of people on the other side of it, on Christine's side of it, that see that she really does have a point. And if you read The Romance of the Rose, you'll see she really does have a point. But again, talking about and defending women is not something that made her ostracized in any way. In fact, it's around this time that Philip of Burgundy, who was Charles V's brother, asks Christine to write a biography of Charles V. So she's asked to write a royal biography by the brother of the late king. Like, this is a huge deal. Not only is this a huge deal for any writer, but she's a woman. She's asked to write this. And it's also, if you look at the edition of the Book of the Mutability of Fortune by Smith, she'll mention it to you in there, that this is the first ever secular biography that we know of in French. So Christine is not suffering from her opinions. In fact, her opinions are what people like from her. And her writing style is extremely solid. Her learning is all there. And so, yeah, she's asked to write a biography of the king, which is a huge, huge deal. So she starts to write that. And in around 1405, she writes The City of Ladies. And this is something that has obviously been percolating in her mind for quite some time. She's thinking about how people have portrayed women, even the people she's admired a lot. So what happens in this is she's thinking about this and she's visited by a couple of apparitions. So I'll read to you how this begins, because I think it's worth reading how it begins. So this is the beginning of the book of The City of Ladies. Following the practice that has become the habit of my life, namely the devoted study of literature, one day, as I was sitting in my study, surrounded by books on many different subjects, my mind grew weary from dwelling at length on the weighty options of authors whom I had studied for so long. I looked up from my book, deciding then to leave subtle questions in peace and to read some lyric poetry for pleasure. With this intention, I searched for some small book, and by chance a strange volume came into my hands, not one of my own, but one which had been given to me for safekeeping along with some others. When I held it open and saw from its title page that it was by Matteolus, I smiled, for though I had never seen it before, I had often heard that, like other books, it discussed respect for women. I thought I would browse through it to amuse myself. I had not been reading for very long when my good mother called me to refresh myself with some supper, for it was evening. Intending to look at it the next day, I put it down. The next morning, again seated in my study as was my habit, I remembered wanting to examine this book by Matteolus. I started to read it and went on for a little while. Because the subject seemed to me not very pleasant for people who do not enjoy lies and of no use in developing virtue or manners, given its lack of integrity in diction and theme, and after browsing here and there and reading the end, I put it down in order to turn my attention to more elevated and useful study. But just the sight of this book, even though it was of no authority, made me wonder how it happened that so many different men, and learned men among them, had been, and are so inclined to express both in speaking and in their treatises and writings so many devilish and wicked thoughts about women and their behavior. Not only one or two, and not even just this Matthäus, for this book had a bad name anyway and was intended as satire, but more generally, judging from the treatises of all philosophers and poets and from all the orators, it would take too long to mention their names. It seems that they all speak from one and the same mouth. They all concur in one conclusion that the behavior of women is inclined to and full of every vice. Thinking deeply about these matters, I began to examine my character and my conduct as a natural woman, and similarly, I discussed this with other women whose company I frequently kept. Princesses, great ladies, women of the middle and lower classes in great numbers, who graciously told me of their private experiences and intimate thoughts, in order to know, in fact, judging in good conscience and without favor, whether the testimony of so many famous men could be true. To the best of my knowledge, no matter how long I confronted or dissected the problem, I could not see or realize how their claims could be true when compared to the natural behavior and character of women. Yet I still argued vehemently against women, saying that it would be impossible that so many famous men, such solemn scholars, possessed of such deep and great understanding, so clear-sighted in all things as it seemed, could have spoken falsely on so many occasions that I could hardly find a book on morals where, even before I had read it in its entirety, I did not find several chapters or certain sections attacking women, no matter who the author was. This reason alone, in short, made me conclude that although my intellect did not perceive my own great faults, and likewise those of other women because of its simpleness and ignorance, it was, however, truly fitting that such was the case. And so I relied more on the judgment of others than on what I myself felt and knew. I was so transfixed in this line of thinking for such a long time that it seemed as if I were in a stupor. Like a gushing fountain, a series of authorities whom I recalled one after another came to mind along with their opinions on this topic, and I finally decided that God formed a vile creature when he made woman, and I wondered how such a worthy artisan could have designed to make such an abominable work, which, from what they say, is the vessel as well as the refuge and abode of every evil and vice. As I was thinking this, a great unhappiness and sadness welled up in my heart, for I detested myself and the entire feminine sex as though we were monstrosities in nature. So there's Christine, and she's thinking about all of the people she's read her whole life and how they are constantly attacking women for perceived vices. And then I just want to read this part of it because it's just so evocative. So this is her, the next thing that happens. So occupied with these painful thoughts, my head bowed in shame, my eyes filled with tears, leaning my cheek on my hand, elbow propped on the pommel of my chair's armrest, I suddenly saw a ray of light fall on my lap, as though it were the sun. With this ray of light come in three apparitions, Lady Reason, Lady Rectitude, and Lady Justice, and they start to explain to Christine that it's not that women are terrible. It's that men have misunderstood them. And so Christine is taken by these women to start to build what she calls the City of Ladies. And it's built with stories of amazing women over the past few thousand years. And it's going to be a place of refuge for all women of all stations for when men start to attack them with bad ideas about them. And this book is just amazing. It would be amazing for a male writer. It's amazing for a female writer of this time. It covers references from classical mythology. It covers references from biblical stories. It covers contemporary references. She talks about all sorts of women and how they have been misread or how they've been forgotten or how their deeds are amazing. Lady Reason, Lady Rectitude, and Lady Justice talk about everybody from the Amazons to biblical women, and it's just amazing. And every argument that Christine dredges up that has been thrown at women gets knocked down, and it's just an amazing piece of work. So I thought I would pull out just one thing for you so you can see how it's built. This is from the section called Against Those Who Say That It Is Not Good That Women Should Pursue Learning. So this is Christine on education. After hearing these things, I, Christine, spoke as follows. Lady, I see well that many good things have come about through women, and if any evil resulted from evil women, it still seems to me that the good things brought about by good women, and also by the wise women, and those learned in literature and the sciences I mentioned above, are more numerous. For this reason, I'm extremely amazed by the opinion of some men who say that they do not want their daughters, wives, or female relatives to study the sciences, and that their morals would worsen through this. Answer. In this, you can clearly see that not all the opinions of men are based on reason, and that these men are wrong. For it should not be assumed that knowing the moral sciences, which teach the virtues, would worsen morals. Rather, there is no doubt that they improve and ennoble them. How is it possible to believe that a person who follows good teaching and doctrine could be the worse for it? Such a thing cannot be uttered or supported. I do not say that it would be good for a man or woman to study the science of sorcery, or those areas that are forbidden, for the Holy Church did not remove them from common usage for nothing. But that women should get worse by knowing good things is not believable. And the three apparitions they mentioned, you know, that Aristotle and Plato and St. Augustine and Aquinas, they contradict themselves constantly in their own work. So we really can't take them as authorities on women. This book, as you can imagine, this was revolutionary for me reading in university. And it was also a book that had a huge reaction at the time. And that doesn't mean that it was a negative reaction. What I mean by this is people didn't ban this book. They copied it and they shared it. And it was copied and shared for hundreds of years in several different languages. This is not the type of book that got Christine Byrne of the stake. It is the type of book that was so popular that she actually wrote a sequel later. So the sequel that she wrote later on was called The Book of the Three Virtues. And this is a book that specifically speaks to women in their different stations in life and tells them how to lead a virtuous life. And I mean, this is an amazing book because it really gets at women where they are. And it's speaking to women, which means that it's assuming that women are going to be audiences for it, whether they're reading it or listening to it. It's obviously also aimed at men because they are going to be people who are in this world with women and have an idea about what they're up against and how they should be instructed as well. Now, this is one of those places where Christine talks a little bit about her widowhood and what she was up against. And I'm telling you, if I was one of these people that was going to have a slogan tattooed on my body, this one from The Book of the Three Virtues by Christina Pizan would be one. She says, "Speak gently, but look out for your rights." And she says this because of her own legal battles. So this is in the section where she's talking about women of her station who are widows. I think you can really kind of feel the struggles that she had when she was trying to get back the money that was owed to her. So here's Christine coming out again, swinging for widow's sake. So she says, in order to achieve these goals, so the legal goals that you have to achieve in life, and to avoid all other troubles, if she, so a woman, a widow, wants to bring the suit to a conclusion, she must take on the heart of a man. She must be constant, strong, and wise in order to decide on and pursue the best course of action, not crouching like a foolish woman in tears and sobs without any defense, like a poor dog who cowers in a corner when all the others attack him. For if you behave like this, women, you will find plenty of people who will take the bread from your hand and will call you ignorant and simple, and you will find no pity in anyone. Therefore, you should not work with only your own intelligence and trust only your own good sense, but get good advice, especially in those areas you know little about. And this is another thing. This is, like, again, something that you might not imagine coming from a medieval woman, but here is what she writes about widowhood in general. And because widowhood means such a hard life for women, as we have in truth seen, it could seem to some people that it would be best for all widows to remarry. This assumption can be answered by saying that if married life were all repose and peace, it would be reasonable for a woman to enter into it again. But since one sees exactly the contrary, women should be warned, although for young women, remarriage might be necessary or suitable. But for those who are past youth and who are sufficiently well off so that poverty does not force them to remarry, it would be complete folly. Although there are some who say that women should not be alone, and they have so little faith in their good sense that they excuse themselves by saying they would not know how to manage their own lives. But the height of folly and the greatest scandal is if an old woman takes a young husband. She will sing a good song only for a short while, and people will not feel sorry for her misfortune, and rightly so. So obviously, Christine has great faith that women who are widowed can take care of themselves. They just have to really be strong because there are going to be a lot of people that are going to take advantage of them. And obviously, she's writing this from her own experience. So after about 1405, she's written The City of Ladies, she's written The Book of the Three Virtues. She starts to write even more influential stuff when it comes to politics. So she starts to write actually a book called A Book of the Body Politic. She starts to write a book called A Book of Deeds and Arms and Chivalry. She writes The Book of Peace. And she writes a lamentation on France's ills. So over the next 5-10 years, Christine is writing books that are telling princes what to do. And this is something that, again, it's mind-boggling that she can do this. She is so respected that she is asked to come across to England to join the court of Henry IV. And you'll remember that her son is still there. And so Christine, she would rather do anything than go work for the English, but she has to say, oh, well, I'll think about this while her son is still there. She never ends up going to England. She is French through and through, despite the fact that she was born in Italy. In 1415, we know that Agincourt was a huge devastation for the flower of French chivalry, as they say. A lot of French nobles died in that battle. And Christine writes about that as well. She writes a letter talking about how difficult this is. It's called The Letter on the Prison of Human Life. And I think that kind of gets at how the French are feeling at this time, how they have to really rely on their faith to get past what is such a big deal for them. So she's not writing as much at this time. And in 1418, she's been in Paris for a long time. But at this time, all hell has broken loose. So we know that the two uncles that were hugely important in the regency of Charles VI, they've been in conflict for years. And this really falls apart when there are assassinations on both sides. And Paris just becomes too hot to handle. So Christine leaves Paris. At this time, she's about 54. And she leaves and she goes to stay with her daughter Marie, who seems to have been a nun at a convent in Poissy. And Christine goes there. And from what seems to be the case, she doesn't write for a decade. She's in the later stages of her life. In around 1425, she loses her son, Jean dies. And so this is a time that's kind of quiet for her, which in a way makes a lot of sense because things are not going well for the French at this time. Things are going really well for the English. They're not going well for the French. And for somebody who's been tied up in French politics her whole life, this is not going to be a tremendously inspirational time to be writing. That said, in 1429, she writes what seems to have been her last work, and this is called A Tale of Joan of Arc. And it is such a happy, triumphant poem praising Joan, because at this point, Joan has come and she's lifted the siege of Orléans, and she has made sure that the Dauphin is crowned at Reims. And this is just a massive cause for celebration in France, and it is for Christine as well. And so she writes her last work, which is in praise of Joan of Arc. Christine dies somewhere around 1430, 1431. And I personally hope that she dies before Joan is executed. It's possible that she dies after that, but hopefully she has died before things go badly for Joan of Arc, because this last poem that Christine has written is just so joyous. I, for one, would not want her to have been around for Joan's downfall. So when Christine has died, she's had a long life. She has put out a huge amount of writing. It's become famous. All of it has been translated and passed around, and it continues to be passed around. So the printing press is invented at the end of the 15th century, so after Christine has died, and her books are some of the early ones that are printed. And they get printed and passed around, especially among the women of Europe. And this makes a whole lot of sense, right? And so a lot of the women of Europe, you know, for a century or more are familiar with Christine's work. One of the people that we know owned a copy of it is Margaret of Austria, a really important woman, and also somebody who Anne Boleyn stayed with when she was on the continent. Anne Boleyn was widely read as well. I mean, she read widely as well. And it seems that her daughter, Elizabeth, had some tapestries, which have disappeared now, that had panels from the City of Ladies on them. Christine was a hugely influential writer. And I'm stating this a lot, not just because I'm a fangirl, but because it's true. And as things started to change in the 1600s, her work started to get printed and reprinted. But as time went on, when it was printed and reprinted in English, Christine started to disappear from it. It started to be translated in a way that suggested that Christine heard men talking about these things. And then she repeated this wisdom. Now, you heard me reading. You've heard me say, "I, Christine." And it is very much "I, Christine." She puts herself forth as being the person who says these words. They are her words. And if that's not clear enough, Christine is actually a really kind of revolutionary writer in that in the Middle Ages, a lot of people didn't take credit for their work. I mean, Christine really needed to because that was her living. But she supervised how her works were created as well, how they were copied, how they were distributed. And you'll notice, if you just do a quick Google search, that Christine made sure that her image, her portrait, was actually in a lot of her works. So if you see a portrait of a woman, she's wearing a blue gown, she's wearing a white veil over kind of a horned headdress, and she often has a little dog with her. You might see her at her desk. This is Christine de Pizan making sure that she is inserted in her own works. And this is another thing that's kind of revolutionary about her. So I'm really hoping that looking at Christine's life and a couple of her works has demonstrated to you how important she was. And this is important to me because, as I've said, she started to disappear in English so that the City of Ladies was not translated for hundreds of years. So it stops being translated around the 17th century, and the City of Ladies is not translated into English until 1982. Like, this is in my lifetime. She wasn't translated again until my lifetime. And so since then, she started to appear in more medieval courses. But I think that we really need to get to know her as well as we know somebody like Chaucer, because she was so influential and because she can really tell us a lot, not only about her time, the things that she suggests, for example, that princes need to do in order to foster peace, the things that women need to do in order to stand up for themselves and have their legal rights. Not only can she tell us about that experience during the Hundred Years' War in France, but also about a human experience, her own experience of motherhood, of widowhood, of trying to make a living in a world that is difficult for her. So hopefully now it's obvious to you why Christine de Pizan is one of my heroes. I hope that you'll track down some of her work and that she'll become one of your heroes too. She's one of my favorite people, and I really encourage everybody to read Christine de Pizan. Most of the translations I used today were from the Norton Selected Writings of Christine de Pizan by Renata Blumenfeld-Kaczynski and Kevin Brownlee, with the exception of the beginning of the Book of the City of Ladies, which was from the translation by Earl Jeffrey Richards. It's Dr. Richards' translation that was done in 1982. I also want to give a shout out to Sophie Bourgault and Rebecca Kingston, who have edited a new version of the Book of the City of Ladies, which puts more of a focus on Christine's role in political science, and is translated by Enika Hardy. The Book of the Mutability of Fortune that I mentioned briefly was edited by Jerry L. Smith. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Well, what's new on the website is a piece on the year 751, which may be one of the most important years in history. So take a look at that. We also have stuff on a Berber queen, and at Mary Magdalene, and we actually have quite a lot. It was a really busy week on medievalist.net, so, and we have a few pieces by you.
Yep, it's a busy week.
Yeah, so come to the site, you can spend hours on it this week.
Sounds like a plan. Thanks, Peter.
You're welcome, bye.
As with Christine, if you're trying to make a living, it's always handy to have patrons. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast have all sorts of goodies available to them, including subscriptions to Medieval Warfare magazine, a book club with Boydell and Brewer, and an ad-free desktop version of medievalist.net. You can find all the action at patreon.com/medievalists. Good news, American friends! My new book, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, is available now on Amazon. It's much earlier than I expected, but that means that you can get a copy for all your favorite people just in time for the holidays. My Canadian friends, you won't have to wait much longer, but you can pre-order now. Thank you so much, everybody, for all the love and support you've shown me so far. For all things medieval, you can follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sabalski, all over social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks so much for listening and for learning about one of my favorite people with me. Have yourself a wonderful day.